You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books and Folklore, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Stephanie Hotok, a host of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Linda Lagarde-Grover about her book, Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Missabe Kong. Linda Lagarde-Grover, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Can you begin with telling us a little bit about your book and what inspired you to write it?
I have written other books, fiction, poetry, and essays, and they all have to do with Ojibwe life, history, culture, contemporary times in the Arrowhead region, which is kind of northeastern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, maybe into the UP of Michigan, that whole area there. I started researching experiences of people who had gone to Indian boarding schools when I was working on my dissertation in the late 1990s. It's a while ago. And I was working on interviews, on an interview project. And from that, from working on my dissertation, I never did publish my dissertation. It was actually really difficult work because of the content, and I began to write fiction, poetry, and essays too. And so eventually then that is where Gichigami Hearts comes in. It is a kind of an interweaving of memoir, I guess, my own story, but also the story of my family, the communities around here, the native communities, but also, you know, with having to do with the non-natives too. I mean, I live in on the tip of Lake Superior here, and we're ringed by like 6 or 8 reservations all within driving distance, and our stories are all interwoven. So with this memoir, collective memoir story, also comes then some poetry that I've written and some essay, and at least one fiction piece in the book that kind of connects some of the old, some aspects of a very old story with life in more contemporary times.
Gitche-Gemi Hearts blends folklore with memoir. How did you decide which folk tales to include in the book to support and enhance your essays?
As I've been writing and living, existing, it occurred to me over a long period of time that the really old foundational stories, what we might call the creation stories of how the world came to be and how it came to be the way it is as we live on it, are people do talk about the stories as being living stories, and that they are our foundation and our guide for living today, the good life, the Minnow Bemadziwin of the Ojibwe people. But it occurred to me as I was giving this a lot of thought and observation, that the stories do teach us our history, are how to act, how to be a good Anishinaabe, sometimes how not to be, but that they also, I've come to believe, are being relived as we speak and as we breathe today. And so that is selecting which stories. I think it just kind of, what would you call it, happened organically, I guess, as when I was writing, that these are what I am seeing as being not parallel, not even interwoven, but I mean, as close as your own skin, I guess, to the ancientness of the stories and our lives today.
Can you tell me a little about how the folklore traditions of your community influenced you as a writer?
Well, we call them the stories. And so they are there to guide us. And so, from a long time ago, I was taught that they are there to show us a way and show us how to be a good person, a good Anishinaabe person. And so that has certainly influenced my writing. What do they say? Life is a journey, not a destination, that saying. And so none of us ever actually can say, oh yes, I have achieved perfection here. Everyone, use my example. That isn't how it is. So we're learning all the time. And I think that this learning probably goes on before we were ever born and after our spirit has left our body too. And so, yeah, it is something to keep in mind and to be your guide as you go through life. We certainly, we've always looked to the elders, to the older people who have a lot of experience in life and have taught us by their example and by what they have told us. And, that has been a guide in what we're doing too. So, older people that I've known, mostly relatives, have certainly guided me as in my life. And then it turns out, certainly in writing.
Okay. In the chapter Rain, Ghost, Fog, Spider, you write that Ojibwe believe that all that happens was meant to be. Have you always been drawn toward writing? And when did you realize that you were meant to share these stories with a wider audience?
I started writing little stories when I was in elementary school, I think. And I've written, sporadically, over many years. I didn't write much when I became an adult. And when I did, I never saved anything I'd done. It wasn't really until I went back to school and was working on my dissertation, actually. And I was in my late 40s by that point, that I started really saving what I had been writing and started sending a poem out here and there to magazines and literary journals and stuff. And eventually I started getting things published. And so now I save Now I save things. Of course, I started at that point saving things on little scraps of paper and hanging on to them. And now, of course, we have, you know, we have computers. So I have a lot of stuff saved on my laptop because I might want to write about it. I think there's a need to give a great deal of thought before I send anything out that I have written, because the stories themselves and our history, everybody's life stories and experiences, you know, they're a sacred thing. And, you know, like life itself, it's not, you know, there's a lot of great gifts there that have been provided, you know, by the Creator, by God, the Great Spirit, for us. But they're not there to just be used up. They're there to be carefully approached in one's life. And that's how I approach writing things too.
Very good. In the chapter Listening and Remembering by Heart, you mentioned that Ojibwe have an oral tradition of telling specific stories at specific times of the year. Can you tell us a little about that tradition and its significance?
The stories about the creation of the world, and that includes just a whole lot of them, they're told in the winter time. And winter time, the way I've learned it, is when there's snow on the ground. And it really is the responsibility of the person sharing the story to follow that. It's out of it's respectful to sometimes it's the animals and birds and the earth that the stories are told about. And so it's when the earth is sleeping, or when the animals are sleeping or gone for the winter, that these stories are told. And it's a greatly honored part of our tradition. And so it's something that I keep. I mean, if I tell a story, it's, you know, if I sit here and recount a story, it is during the winter time when there's snow on the ground. There are other stories though. I mean, you know, there are romances and ghost stories and funny stories and, you know, recountings of history and things that, you know, can be shared any time during the year. It's not that something terrible is going to happen to you if you do not respect this tradition, but it's so important to respect things that were handed down by our elders, because they did the same thing. And our handing them down, handing these ways of being down, is how we continue as Anishinaabe people.
In the chapter Woods, Lovely, Dark, and Deep, you share the importance of hitting each point in a story at the place that point is designed to be, and how that is considered more important than simply memorizing a story. How has that practice influenced you as a professional writer?
When a person shares one of the sacred stories, that person has heard it many times, listened to it many times, and understands there's a feeling for at what point things happen. And so that is as important in carrying on the tradition as the story itself. And so it's more than memorizing. And every person telling a story may have their own way of telling, or sometimes their own embellishments, especially the funnier parts, that some of the stories are funny and sad and scary and, you know, all at the same time. But the basic elements must always be there and at that point in the story. And so it's keeping a tradition. So how to integrate that into one's own writing, whether it's the sacred stories themselves, or an essay or a poem, or a piece of fiction that may have elements of one of the old stories in that others who read it may or may not recognize. I think that it is important to be mindful of that rhythm of telling and recounting.
Very good. In reading Rain, Ghost, Fog, Spider, I was moved by your interactions with Artel and his story. Can you share a little about Artel and how the power of shared stories and traditions strengthened your connection with him?
Artel appeared one day, and that's at the beginning of this story. Is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? It's nonfiction. He appeared one day, and it was, you know, something that was one of those things that's meant to be. And he was, you know, he was cold and he was wet and he had walked a long way and wanted to talk with me and to give me something. And so he is the person who decided to initiate this long walk and this conversation. He knew that I had been, I mean, this is Indian country, and so people talk a lot and information goes along, you know, between friends and along, you know, I don't know if they still call it the moccasin telegraph, but that's a term that used to be used. And he came and he told me that he'd heard that I was doing some research and that I was writing about Indian boarding schools, and he wanted to talk with me. And so I was done with everything with my dissertation. I was getting ready to present it. They used to call it defending it, but I'm not defending anything. I was ready to talk about it with the committee that would decide if it was acceptable or not, and whether they did or not wouldn't change this a bit. And so it was one of those times where all a person can do is just kind of continue breathing and go along with it. I mean, certainly I would never have said, well, I'm actually all done with that, but let me take some notes. I mean, that wasn't it at all. This was a very important occasion that was just a gift, you know, dropped on us by the creator and by this man who was so generous. And so without him, my dissertation and my existence as a human being would not be what they are.
As your book wraps up, you share an email exchange about your grandfather, Elias, and pose the question of who owns our stories. How do you approach that question in the context of folklore and family histories?
Our stories are sacred stories. I mean, nobody owns them. Then actually nobody knows them all. So, and that's a good thing. And that is by design of the creator. No one person knows the whole thing. There are some people who know quite a number of these stories. There are some who might know one or a couple, and maybe people haven't really heard them before. But altogether, between the people who are caring for these stories and understand the tremendous gift and responsibility, and the listeners too, there is a holiness about this in the passing of this knowledge is how I think of it. In writing about my grandfather, who had a really, really difficult life, and my family was a boarding school family, and so for two or three generations it was common, it was expected, it was what happened. It grew to be what we were and what we are, I think, that children would be removed from home and sent far enough away that they couldn't get home, and they would be schooled after a fashion. And it was, you know, most of the time it was really lousy schooling anyway, combined with treatment that was indifferent and sometimes even cruel, and sometimes very the assimilation of these children into larger American society, which involved changing them in every way. I mean, they could not practice their religious beliefs or their customs. They were not allowed to speak their own language. They had to speak English. They had to live in a regimented style that was so different from everything they'd ever known. And yet at home, people were being squeezed to send their children away. I mean, there were communities where, you know, like on reservations where government commodity foods were being shipped in to people who no longer lived in the type of, were not able to live in the sustenance lifestyle that they had before. So they were being able, you know, sent commodity food. Only enough was sent in some communities for everybody over 18, which meant that there was no food, not enough food to feed children, things like this. And people were told, and I've heard this many times, and I've heard this even in my own family, that people were told, you cannot do this. You cannot raise your children. This is gone. Everything you knew is gone, and it's just as well. It's gone, and you can't save yourself. You're stuck in that old time that's no longer relevant. But one thing you can do is save your children, and we're going to take them, and then your children will survive. And I think, my God, what an awful thing to have to put into your mind and your heart as a parent or grandparent or community person. And so when I think about my grandfather and the tremendous difficulties he had, and yet in the book I wrote that, yes, actually he shone. I mean, he shone with a light that it was beyond what had the terrible blanket of assimilation that had been tossed on to us. And so I write about that a lot. And that was one of life's experiences too, where I received an email from a woman just saying that she was Linda Lagarde related to Elias, because she had known him when she was a girl, a young woman. And she's my age. And I thought, oh, there's more to this. And I really hesitated. Was I afraid of what she might tell me or something? I sort of lost her email and didn't know. And then in the book, I do write about this, that I thought, you know what, I'm going to put it on Facebook, a long shot. Does anybody know this woman? Didn't remember her name. And she said she couldn't sleep one night and opened up her Facebook, and this kind of popped up on her Facebook feed. I mean, what are the odds of that happening? And so then she contacted me again, and that's how we got together. And that was something, you know, often they talk about closing the circle and coming full circle and healing and stuff. I don't really necessarily believe in that. And yet at this point, going for a cup of tea, just on the edge of the pandemic, when we wouldn't be able to meet anymore, we met just before everything hit the fan. And we spent those hours together. And I thought to myself that this is, I don't know if it's full circle, but it is a large piece of the puzzle that came to fit in what I know of a greatly loved grandfather who left the world in really sad under very sad circumstances.
Do you have a favorite folk tale that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, of the stories, my favorite story actually has to do with Gagoons, the little porcupine, and how he kept his gentle nature, and with the help of Nanabuju, our great spirit hero, was able to defend himself, yet still remain a peaceable and good being. And that's my very favorite story. So I really enjoy that, and I also enjoy putting my own little spin on a couple little parts of it, where Nanabuju is, all right, in my part of this, as in a little aside here, Nanabuju is going to teach him how to box. Oh. So that wasn't actually part of the traditional story, but the pondering over how to defend oneself was.
That's great. I like it. Okay. And now for our final question, where can readers purchase this wonderful book, and where can they learn more about you and your work?
Well, you know, if you just do an internet search, you'll probably find me. Gichigami Hearts is carried in some independent bookstores in the region here. It can be purchased online from the University of Minnesota Press. And in our Barnes & Noble up here in Duluth carries it. And it has been very recently selected to be the 2022 Northland Read for the regions up here, the libraries. And so, yeah, so it is available. It is in paperback, which I really like because it makes it an affordable and accessible book. And I have to just say, I really love the cover because the cover has a black background with beautiful beadwork on it. And it is an actual photo of beadwork done by Jessica Goki, who is a bead artist from Northern Wisconsin.
All right. Well, we've taken a lot of your time today, and I really appreciate you being here with us. Dr. Grover, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
I appreciate this too. Thank you.